Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 32, and it's a very special Ancient Philosophy Society episode. In this episode, I've recorded the paper that I gave at the Ancient Philosophy Society, which was occurred on April 22nd through the 25th at Michigan State University. It was the 10th anniversary of the APS, and I was particularly privileged to be able to present a paper on community in that context. So what follows is that paper, the commentary from Anne-Marie Bowery, and then the question and answer period that followed. So enjoy.
So our first paper today on the Plato panel by Christopher Long of Pennsylvania State University, paper entitled The Crisis of Community, the Topology of Socratic Politics in the Protagoras. Chris?
Thank you, Mark, for introducing me and for hosting, for moderating this panel. This is a paper on community, and it is appropriate for me to present it here, I think, in a society and in a setting that has been such an important community of learning for me, and particularly meaningful because this is our 10th anniversary, and we have come quite a long way since those first years at Villanova. And one of the things that it's been really meaningful to me about the society, and you'll hear this, I think, in the paper, is the way that friends here, old and new, have helped me cultivate the excellences of dialogue with which I'm really concerned in this paper. So the paper is part of a larger project, and I also want to thank the people who have been engaged with some of my work through the Digital Dialogue podcast, which I started last summer and has been rewarding in all kinds of ways that I can't even begin to talk about. So this paper really comes out of that dialogue with many of you here, some of you here as well. Crisis of Community, the Topology of Socratic Politics in the Protagoras. At what appears to be the very center of the Protagoras, a dialogue that is itself situated almost exactly in the middle of the course of Socrates' life, the discussion between Protagoras and Socrates threatens to break down. At first, Socrates senses the crisis, then he exacerbates it. When Protagoras resists for a third time Socrates' insistence that the conversation proceed by short responses to specific questions, he appeals explicitly to the name he has earned in all of Greece by entering contests of speech and refusing to acquiesce to the terms of his opponent. In response, Socrates determined that there was no point in his remaining at the gathering. This is the context in which Socrates says, quote, "I've got something else to do and wouldn't be able to hang around while you reeled out long speeches. I'll be off. The fact is, there's somewhere I really must be going." End quote. Although we might surmise that Socrates indulges here in polite duplicity as a sort of social graciousness, so as not to insult Protagoras, which is how I read it when I first read the dialogue, the claim that there is somewhere he must go is reaffirmed at the very end of the dialogue when Socrates says, quote, "In any case, I said a while back that it was the proper time," and the Greek word there is hora, "for me to go." Thus, Socrates' claim at the moment of crisis in the middle that he has something else to do is perhaps not as disingenuous as it at first appears. Indeed, at the very beginning of the dialogue, we are given a sense of what might have been pressing upon Socrates, a meeting with a friend. And I'll use friend for now, although I think Anne-Marie will call into question the status of this friend. But friend. The dialogue begins this way. "Whence, Socrates, do you appear?" The question is voiced by an unnamed friend or companion. And as Denier has suggested, the phrase itself, quote, has something of the air of "where have you been all this time?" as if the friend has been waiting for Socrates, anticipating his appearance. As performed rather than narrated, the question captures a moment of encounter as it intrudes upon the course of a life. It announces the moment when Socrates appears to his friend as at once long anticipated and yet still as somehow unexpected. The question, pothen, whence, frames the entire dialogue as a kind of apology, one in which Socrates attempts to justify his tardiness and legitimize his decision to spend his time with Protagoras at the house of Callias. Thus, if the beginning of the dialogue is read from the perspective of its end, Socrates is shown to have had some place to go throughout. He has had a friend to meet. The dialogue at once interrupts the course of Socrates' life, even as it announces this course as a concern throughout. In the end, Socrates tells Protagoras, quote, "In your story, Prometheus was pleasing to me more than Epimetheus. For I concern myself with these things because I am consulting him and taking care over the whole of my life." Here, the dialogue, which is traditionally and not incorrectly said to concern the teaching of virtue, or the question of the teachability of virtue, is said to bear upon the entire course of Socrates' life. And the question concerning human excellence and how to cultivate it in oneself and others is also, however, here shown to bear upon the course of the lives of those one encounters. So just pause here because Catherine Zuckert's here, and there is something I think very significant about the fact that this crisis in the dialogue that I pointed to at the beginning happens in the middle of the dialogue, and the dialogue itself seems to be basically in the middle of Socrates' life itself. So if we take a dramatic perspective and read the dialogues in a dramatic order according to the life of Socrates, that resonates with what I want to talk about here with regard to the notion of the proper time. And that life is not just about Socrates' life, but the life of those he encounters. And so, in this case, it concerns specifically the course of the life of Hippocrates, who woke Socrates before dawn and caused him to alter his plans for the day. So, the proper time. The crisis at the center of the dialogue should then be heard as conditioned by a particular temporality that frames the dialogue as a whole. When, at the very end, Protagoras puts off Socrates' invitation to speak from the beginning in order to have a thorough look together into what it is to be a virtuous person, he says, now, however, it's already the proper time to turn to something else. To this, as mentioned, Socrates responds by echoing the appeal to the proper time, the hora. If it seems so to you, it is necessary to do this. In any case, I said a while back that it was the proper time for me to go. For I only stayed to gratify Callias, because he is so beautiful. And the Greek there is sing-songy on Callias. Right? So the appeal to the proper time at the end not only draws our attention to the crisis in the middle in which Socrates insists that he has obligations elsewhere, but it also returns us to the very beginning of the dialogue where the friend surmises that Socrates has been hunting the ripe young Alcibiades. Specifically, the friend asks after the proper time, and in so asking, playfully reveals himself as familiar with the erotic ways of Socrates. Quote, "But it is clear that you've been hunting the blooming youth of Alcibiades, peritein alcibiadu horon. Indeed, he appeared to me, and just the other day I saw the still beautiful man. But man, nevertheless, Socrates, for to speak just between us, his beard is already filling in." End quote. The proper time here is bound to the time of youth when a young man is, to quote the lines of Homer to which Socrates himself appeals, quote, "with beard new grown, which is the most graceful time of young manhood." The reference here in Homer is to Hermes, who appears to Priam as such a graceful young man, having been sent by Zeus to escort Priam to the Greek encampment to attempt to retrieve from Achilles the body of his son Hector. Hermes is the traveling god of the in-between who frequents the terrestrial sphere conversing with mortals and traversing the boundary between the divine and human. He is, as Norman Brown puts it, quote, the guide who presides over all comings in and goings out, the ambassador who protects men in their dealings with strangers. To identify Alcibiades with Hermes, as Plato implicitly does here, is already to emphasize the earthly journey on which Socrates has embarked. In the Protagoras, this journey is shown to be led by an image of Hermes, Alcibiades, who, as Socrates himself says, today especially spoke up for me and came to my aid many times. Alcibiades thus serves as a kind of ambassador who protects Socrates in his dealings with the stranger Protagoras. Indeed, Alcibiades speaks up for Socrates and comes to his aid at three decisive moments in the course of the conversation when it is in jeopardy of failing as a dialogue. If, then, the Protagoras is framed by the temporality of the proper time, it is introduced as a journey guided by a phantom of Hermes. This suggests, indeed, an itinerary for a reading of the dialogue in which those moments when Alcibiades speaks up for Socrates are heard to defer his departure and thus to situate him and us in the middle of a discussion of excellence with a community of young men intent on wielding power in the city. In pursuing this itinerary, we find ourselves situated in a determinate socio-temporal terrain, the contours of which can be discerned as the proper topology of Socratic politics. The topology of Socratic politics, which is initially marked in the dialogue by the temporality of the hora, the proper time, is here articulated by a discourse erotically oriented toward the question of excellence. The proper time thus appears in this dialogue as intimately bound up with the erotic dimension of human excellence. The hora marks finite organic temporality, rooted in the rhythms of a natural life and oriented by the fertility endemic to erotic relation. In the end and in the beginning, the hora gestures to the course of a life erotically animated by a certain way of engaging in philosophical discourse. So that was a comment about the temporality. Now a little bit about the space or the place of Socratic politics. The crisis in the middle that appears in the very middle of the Protagoras is itself resolved, at least for the moment, by an intervention of those present. The moment Socrates gets up to leave, Callias physically restrains him. So constrained, Socrates attempts to clarify his understanding of being with one another in community by insisting on a difference between dialogue and demagoguery. The former, Socrates says, is the sort of talking capable of cultivating a genuine community in which words are tested in ways that call people engaged in dialogue themselves to account. Demagoguery, by contrast, is the sort of talking endemic to the politics practiced in the assembly. It is animated by the spirit of competition and seeks influence by persuasion. This difference has here come to crisis, for it was precisely the way Protagoras couched the conversation in agonistic terms and, appealing to his reputation throughout Greece, refused to speak in the manner Socrates was requesting that determined Socrates to leave. Here, Alcibiades breaks into the conversation, speaking up for Socrates for the first of three times. The moment Callias defends Protagoras' right to speak however he pleases is when Alcibiades comes in. Yet in speaking up for Socrates here, Alcibiades defends an impoverished understanding of dialogue that remains fundamentally agonistic and thus incapable of cultivating the genuine being together with one another Socrates seems to seek. For Alcibiades, like Hermes himself, is keen on competition and formulates his defense of Socrates in agonistic terms. As the group attempts to convince Socrates to put off the proper time to depart, Hippias makes a speech in which he explicitly asks and advises Socrates and Protagoras to come together into the middle, with us as arbiters bringing you together. If the proper time marks the temporal dimension of the topology of Socratic politics, Hippias's formulation articulates its spatial dimension, the site where the transformative possibilities of dialogue play themselves out. Socratic politics is practiced where two individuals come into immediate or direct relation in the middle. Thus, Socrates refuses Hippias' suggestion that a moderator be chosen, insisting that if there is to be a supervisor, you all in common can preside. This suggests the degree to which the topology of Socratic politics also involves being situated in the middle of a community whose members are enjoined to reflect upon the course and direction of the dialogue itself. So, speaking in one's own voice and listening together, trying to determine a little bit further what this community of learning and community of dialogue might be like. Socrates and Protagoras are disposed differently to the community in which they find themselves. Charles Griswold has emphasized the poignantly choreographed scene of Protagoras walking up and down the colonnade at Callias's mansion with a number of people trailing behind him on either side, mesmerized by his spellbinding voice, all, quote, taking great care in no way to be a hindrance to the path of Protagoras. I think we know some faculty like that. For Griswold, the scene indicates the authoritative presence of Protagoras. Contrast this with Socrates' response to Hippocrates, who came pounding on his door just before dawn. Given the time and the urgency of Hippocrates' arrival, Socrates is at first genuinely concerned with his well-being and is relieved when he learns that Hippocrates is there not because something bad has happened, but because Protagoras is in town. Socrates enters into direct personal relation with Hippocrates, taking his enthusiasm over as his own. And there's a larger story one could tell here, but I'm not telling it here at the moment, about the way in Socrates takes that story of Hippocrates and then joins him as not just as Hippocrates' project, but his own. And yet, even as Socrates enters into a community of relation with Hippocrates, he is already beginning to shift the focus of the young man's erotic energies. For the main effect of the conversation that he then has with Hippocrates is to alert Hippocrates to the dangers of the undertaking he proposes, introducing a comparison with the decision-making process Hippocrates would have undertaken had he been considering which doctor to see. Socrates emphasizes what is at stake, quote, "But here it concerns that which you believe to be greater than your body, namely your soul, that by which you yourself become deserving or worthless, by means of all the things that you do, either well or badly," end quote. Now, to his credit, Hippocrates has turned to Socrates for advice concerning the most important undertaking. So I think that says a lot about Hippocrates. That's good judgment right there. And Socrates responds, not by speaking to him in abstractions, but by entering into dialogue with him, turning his attention to the condition of his soul and the impact this condition will have on the course of his entire life. But most decisively, for the attempt to delineate the topology of Socratic politics, Socrates adjusts his plans for the day, recognizing that now is the proper time to go along with Hippocrates and to seek together precisely how the young man will be affected if he enters into a community of association with Protagoras. So that's part of what I want to get at, is Socrates' willingness to engage with those he meets in such a way that his own course of life is changed. So now this will turn me to the second moment when Alcibiades speaks up for Socrates. He speaks up for a second time at the end of Socrates' clever interpretation of Simonides by silencing Hippias, and when he suggests that he too might offer an account. We're very grateful. I was particularly grateful to have Alcibiades speak up at that moment. It's perplexing enough what Socrates is doing, let alone if we had to hear Hippias do it again, do his version. The turn to poetry was initiated by Protagoras, and by his claim that, quote, "the greatest part of being an educated man is to be clever concerning poetry." In silencing Hippias, Alcibiades allows Socrates to turn the course of the discussion away from poetry and back to the question of dialogue. This turn marks not only a shift in the course of the dialogue, but also a powerful critique of the vision of the educated persons Pythagoras seems to advocate. The problem with orienting education toward the clever interpretation of poetry is, for Socrates, that it relies too heavily on the voice of another and fails to cultivate the ability to speak in one's own voice. In juxtaposing those uneducated and vulgar people who rely on poetry for entertainment with those beautiful and good people who have been educated, Socrates invokes the question of voice. The former are unable to speak in their own voice in cultivating a community of association with one another, relying instead on the voices of the poets. Those who have been educated, however, because they are sufficient themselves with themselves, are able to enter into community without that sort of silly talk and childish play, but through their own voice, speaking and listening in turn, end quote. For Socrates, the sign of an educated person is the capacity to speak in one's own voice and to listen in good order. These are the excellences capable of cultivating a genuine community of education. Socrates then goes on to turn his attention explicitly to this community here, namely the community in which he is at presently situated, insisting that the same thing applies, for they should not rely on an outside voice, quote, who can't be asked about the things they say, end quote, but rather they should set aside the poets and make speeches with one another through our own voices, attempting ourselves, with ourselves, to apprehend the truth. The shift from they to we ourselves is decisive, for it underscores precisely what is at stake for Socrates, the community of education that has emerged between them, and by extension, the community of learning Hippocrates can expect to enter should he join Pythagoras. For Socrates, a community of learning is marked by a certain poiesis, not that of the poets, but that of educated people engaged in dialogue with one another, relying on their own voices in an attempt to apprehend the truth. This sort of making is, then, an essaying that involves speaking and listening in turn. It is deeply dialogical, self-reliant, and communal. Indeed, it involves a testing not only of ideas, but also of each individual member of the community of learning. So final section, justice and a sense of shame. This wrenching critique of his conception of education seems to have been disconcerting to Pythagoras. For Socrates reports that he would not give a straight response as to how to proceed. And now Alcibiades enters for a final time, leaning over to Callias to ask if he thinks Pythagoras is doing beautifully. Alcibiades himself insists that he's not. Socrates reports that he sensed that Pythagoras was embarrassed by Alcibiades' comments. And one thing that's interesting in the dialogue is the embarrassment that Hippocrates feels early on when he admits that he might want to be a sophist, or that at least that's where his argument about why he wants to learn from Pythagoras. So there's a theme of this blushing in the dialogue. Alcibiades again speaks in the spirit of Hermes, who, on Pythagoras' own earlier account, was said to have brought shame, Ido, and justice, Dike, to human beings. And then these were precisely the things that Hermes brought to make human beings become political beings. In making Pythagoras feel ashamed, Alcibiades comes to the aid of Socrates as he attempts to leverage Pythagoras' existing concern for how he appears to others in an attempt to cultivate a genuine community of learning between them. If Hermes brings justice together with shame, Socrates, with the help of Alcibiades, deploys shame to make Pythagoras feel the truth about himself, that his concern for the opinions of others was not rooted in a genuine concern for them and his community with them, but for himself and his own reputation among the Greeks. although Socrates is ultimately unable to establish a community of dialogue with Protagoras, someone seems to have learned from this failure of dialogue in the dialogue. In the end, Hippocrates seems to have left with Socrates. Indeed, the dialogue concludes with an enigmatic sentence that at once returns us to its beginning and suggests something of its success. Quote, having said and heard these things, we left. If Socrates fails to establish a community of dialogue with Protagoras, he seems to have succeeded in teaching Hippocrates something about excellence. For the final word, apeimen, articulated in the first person plural, suggests that Hippocrates left with Socrates, having learned that the soul is nourished in a community of dialogue with others committed to talking things through together, each speaking in one's own voice and responding in ways that cultivate excellence. Thus, the dialogue itself demonstrates the contours of the topology of Socratic politics, a space of appearing determined as much by a certain time as by a situated place. The temporal dimension of this topology has been heard in the appeal to the proper time, to the hora, that articulates the rhythmic unfolding endemic to the course of life. Indeed, Socratic politics is itself always rooted in the hora, for it is always concerned with the course of the life of an individual and the proper time in which it might be turned toward the question of the good. This turning is made, however, possible by the cultivation of a community of dialogue in which those involved respond to one another, relying on their own voices in an attempt to articulate the truth. And this is the site of Socratic politics and the place to which Hermes has led us. Thank you.
Anne Marie is going to comment.
Don't worry, the comments look a lot longer than they are. I just didn't want to wear my glasses to have to see the page. I very much enjoyed Chris Long's engaging reading of the Protagoras. I find little to disagree with about his overall reading. Indeed, I am particularly intrigued by the claim that Socrates has been planning to meet with the unnamed auditor all along. Prior to reading Long's paper, I was one of those readers who sees Socrates' attempt to leave at the middle and his departure at the end as a polite excuse, as a sort of reverse Euthyphro move, if you will. Socrates really doesn't want to converse with his inferior interlocutors any longer, and so makes up a pressing engagement elsewhere. However, if this auditor is who Socrates is supposed to meet all along, then it does change how we should understand the relationship between Socrates and the auditor, which is closely related to a particular interest of mine in the dialogues, namely the narrative dimensions of them. So I am left wondering precisely who this auditor is, and if the dialogue gives us clues that would help us understand the voluntary communal associations in which Socrates practices philosophy. Long describes the Socratic community in this way. For Socrates, the community of learning is marked by a certain poesis, not that of the poets, but that of educated people engaged in dialogue with one another, relying on their own voices in an attempt to apprehend the truth. This sort of making is then an essaying that involves speaking and listening in turn. It is deeply dialogical, self-reliant, and communal. Indeed, it involves a testing not only of ideas, but also of each individual member of the community of learning. So I ask again, who is this auditor, and does his initial exchange with Socrates support the idea that he and Socrates share this sort of community? I think we will see by looking at the text that the answer is both yes and no. The Protagoras begins as an unnamed companion asks Socrates, whence or where have you just come from? Though Robert Bartlett correctly observes that the text refers to the companion as a heteros rather than the more intimate philos, it does seem that he and Socrates know each other fairly well. For example, he observes some aspect of Socrates' demeanor that enables him to answer his own opening query about Socrates' activities. He remarks, "It seems indeed clear that you've been hunting the Alcibiades, who's in his prime." Socrates acknowledges that his assumption is correct. And I might just add here, I didn't put this in the comments, but the last word of the dialogue, "I've only just now left him," could well include Alcibiades as well as Hippocrates. And if so, then that's even a larger community that would be instantiated at the end of the enacted part of the dialogue. Second, the joking manner in which the auditor and Socrates converse about the appropriate age for a beloved and about Socrates' interest in Alcibiades suggests a friendly relationship between them. And third, Socrates wants to tell the auditor about something strange that happened to him. So just as the auditor knows Socrates well enough to surmise that he had been with Alcibiades, Socrates seems to know the auditor well enough to recognize that a story about Protagoras will eclipse his interest in Alcibiades. Indeed, after Socrates mentions Protagoras, the auditor does not refer to Alcibiades again. Fourth, the auditor ascertains that Socrates has the leisure to narrate the account, which contrasts with Chaerephon's commanding insistence that Socrates narrate the account of the battle at Potidæa at the opening of the Charmides. Socrates confirms his enthusiasm for the tasks. "Indeed, I count it a favor," he says, "if you listen." The auditor affirms that this feeling is reciprocal. Socrates then again repeats that he would consider it a favor, this time calling it a double favor. The fact that Socrates repeats this word charon emphasizes the gratitude on both sides of the relationship and a mutual obligation that's established between them. This opening scene, then, does seem to present a model of reciprocity between speaker and listener that is not present in many of the other Socratically narrated dialogues. What do we know, then, about the auditor himself? First, we know that he's fascinated with Alcibiades and Socrates' relationship. And in some ways, I'd say this auditor's fascination with Alcibiades is not surprising. Deborah Nellis has pointed out that Alcibiades was, and many other people, very prominent at this time. And the dramatic date of this dialogue, he was about 20 years old and an extremely popular figure. He was strong, handsome, intelligent, showing great aptitude for political success. And so from the auditor's intense curiosity about this relationship, which the auditor assumes to be erotic, we can extrapolate that the auditor is interested in erotic matters more generally. The fact that Socrates brings up other examples of lover-beloved relationships throughout his narrative commentary bears out this assumption. And it may well be that the auditor's erotic orientation illustrates the predominant role that his emotions play in the governing of his life. Second, Socrates specifically refers to the auditor as an admirer of Homer. Socrates makes this descriptive comment in response to the auditor's query about his relationship with Alcibiades. And in this way, Socrates links the auditor's questions about Alcibiades with his enthusiasm for Homer. And indeed, references to Homer and Alcibiades occur throughout Socrates' narrative commentary as well. We should see this linking as further indication of the auditor's emotional nature. Homeric poetry, indeed, appeals to the emotional dimensions of human experience, and it's a large part of the Socratic critique of poetry in the Republic. So, third, and this is one point I would say that seems to work a little bit against Chris's assumption that it was a planned meeting. Okay? The auditor does not seem to travel in the same intellectual circles as Socrates. He does not know about Protagoras' arrival in Athens. However, once the auditor learns of Protagoras' presence, he is quite interested. This quick shift in focus of his interest suggests that his emotional interests also color his enthusiasm for the sophist as well. Many aspects of the auditor's behavior indicate his lack of enthusiasm for intellectual matters. In addition to being unaware of Protagoras' presence in Athens, he seems not to sense any irony in Socrates' remark regarding Protagoras' wisdom. Also, the auditor does not interrupt Socrates at any point to ask questions of him throughout the long narrative, nor do we see how the auditor responds to Socrates' narrative at the end of the dialogue. Patrick Kobe takes the auditor's silence to indicate his lack of intellectual aptitude. He simply wants to be entertained by Socrates' account of Protagoras, much like one would be entertained by listening to a muse recounting a Homeric tale. If so, it seems unlikely that Socrates has previously planned to meet the auditor, as Chris suggests. However, Robert Bentley sees the auditor's enthusiasm for Protagoras as reflecting a deeper intellectual interest, and some aspects of the test support this interpretation. For example, the auditor seems eager to know what is up with Alcibiades and Socrates after he hears about Protagoras. The auditor seems even more insistent about hearing Socrates' account. Well, sit right down and tell us if you're free now. Tell us about it. His insistence that Socrates sit down and his remark about Socrates now being free does seem to support Chris's claim that this was a planned encounter. And if so, this is the last kind of point I'll make, the interruption that the Hippocrates encounter creates, the interruption that ends up keeping Socrates from this meeting, proves to be particularly fortuitous. For Hippocrates' own situation very much mirrors the auditor's own. If Socrates plans to meet the auditor are indeed interrupted by Hippocrates, Socrates turns this interruption into a pedagogical opportunity for the auditor. As Socrates retells the story, it turns out that the story of Hippocrates is precisely what the auditor needs to hear. Hippocrates shares the auditor's emotionality, his erotic nature, and his enthusiasm for Protagoras. We see all of these traits in his extended exchange with Socrates. Hippocrates manifests extreme emotionality from beginning of the narrative. Just before daybreak, while it was still dark, Hippocrates banged on my door with his stick, and when it was opened for him, he barged right in and yelled in that voice of his, "Socrates, are you awake or asleep?" Socrates presents Hippocrates as an aggressive, loud, excitable person. And as the narrative progresses, his forwardness unfolds even further. He enters Socrates' bedroom, locates the bed, and sits at his feet. Hippocrates' entrance in the bedroom casts the entire scene in an erotic light. The name of Hippocrates' slave, Satyrus, adds to the erotic overtones of this episode. The details that Socrates includes in his narrative enable us to see how Hippocrates' emotional exuberance creates an instability in his daily life. For example, Satyrus has run away. Hippocrates intends to tell Socrates about this event, but forgets. Because of his inability to control his slave, quite literally his inability to control a symbol of Eros, Hippocrates does not learn of Protagoras' arrival until later. After his brother tells him about Protagoras, Hippocrates wants to see Socrates immediately. Realizing it is too late to visit Socrates, Hippocrates eats and sleeps. However, his excitement about Protagoras is so great that he disregards social convention and arrives early at Socrates' house. Even after he arrives at Socrates' house, his exuberance for seeing Protagoras remains unchecked. He wants to go to Callias' house immediately. Socrates cautions him about the early hour and instead leads him from the bedroom into the courtyard. This change in physical location symbolizes Socrates' desire to move Hippocrates and the auditor away from their emotionally driven enthusiasm for Protagoras and toward a more cautious stance with respect to their learning. Just as Socrates physically moves him from the erotically charged setting of the bedroom to a more neutral one, Socrates engages him in a philosophical discussion to move away from his unreflective enthusiasm for Protagoras. As Hippocrates and Socrates move from the darkness of the bedroom into the light of the courtyard, they symbolically leave Hippocrates' unreflective enthusiasm for Protagoras behind. The fact that Protagoras is usually found indoors and that Socrates conducts his various activities outdoors reinforces this symbolic movement. In sum, I think Chris is quite right to point out the possibility that this opening encounter with the auditor is planned from the beginning. And particularly, I think it's important to see that because it also points attention to the importance of the narrative frame of the dialogue more generally, because it's in Socrates' narrative retelling that we actually see an additional instantiation of this kind of Socratic political and pedagogical community that Chris is talking about. The narrative dimensions of this dialogue and the others narrated by Socrates allow us to see how Socrates' pedagogy works on two levels. First, within the temporality of the dramatic events, Socrates provides an external restraint for Hippocrates' emotional exuberance. Second, on the narrative level, by starting with this episode about Hippocrates, Socrates restrains the auditor's enthusiasm to hear about Protagoras. Just as Socrates makes Hippocrates wait for daylight and engage in conversation with him before they head to Callias' house, Socrates makes the auditor wait to hear about his encounter with Protagoras. Just as Socrates uses Olynkus to provoke Hippocrates into considering what he hopes to gain from study, Socrates uses narrative to provoke the auditor into a reflection about his enthusiasm for Protagoras and the participatory pedagogy that Socrates advocates. In doing so, Socrates hopes to create the sort of philosophical community for which he longs.
Okay, so in the interest of speaking and listening in turn, I will limit my comment just to two things. The first is I really appreciate the emphasizing of the parallel that may be happening between Hippocrates and Socrates and this unnamed auditor and Socrates, and I think that we could nest that even more. I think we could think about the Protagoras-Socrates relationship as involved in the same kind of process, then as at the very sort of core of this, Hippocrates-Socrates, then we have the auditor in Socrates, and there's kind of a mirroring and parallelism. But then we also have to take the next step, which is the dialogue in us. The distinction which I gestured to in a footnote, but don't, and I'm still thinking through, so I hesitate even to talk about it. So I try to make a distinction between topology of Socratic politics, which is trying to attend to the performative dimensions of the practice of politics in the dialogues themselves, the character of Socrates practicing politics. I'm trying to figure out what is that politics about, what is he doing. But that's not unrelated to what I would want to call the topography of Platonic politics, which is the moves that Plato makes in putting this character in these particular situations and encouraging and that having a political effect on us or a transformative effect on us. So I appreciate that parallel, because it helps also us think about the dialogue in relation to us. Let me defend myself a little bit about the intellectual circles. I mean, come on. I mean, Socrates isn't going to be constrained by intellectual circles, right? I mean, he'll go seek out all sorts of people, right? So that this guy's in the intellectual circle or not is. But in some ways, you know, all of the details about, well, who this person is, I'd be interested. I'd love to play with that stuff. We could think about that. I'll be interested in all sorts of ideas. But I think the crucial point for me is to try to defend the idea that Socrates had some place to go, or that he's willing to change his plans. I'm not giving you a compelling argument for the fact that he really meant what he said in these contexts. The larger point, I think, is important, which is that Socrates is a kind of teacher, the kind of person who is engaged with the people that he encounters to the extent that he's willing to change the course of his own life. Now we're talking about the course of this day, but I think what larger, he's concerned with that. What is the course of my life? And he wants those he encounters to be concerned with that too. And I think that's really at the core of Socratic politics. And so the meaning of that term, what is Socratic politics, has to be seen as being practiced by Socrates in every relationship he has, in every moment, in all the dialogues. So I'll stop there. Thank you, Larry. Am I fielding?
You want to field?
Yeah, I'll field. Okay, Rob.
I'm wondering if there's a similar sort of ambivalence about DK and the role of the DK in Socratic dialogue, if you had a chance.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. I mean, the notion of eidos and shame is a complex one, and you point to part of the complexity. And I do think I would want to suggest a lot more needs to be said about that moment in the Protagoras where Protagoras says Hermes brought these two gifts, and it's precisely these two gifts and how they relate to one another, Dike and Eidos, shame and justice, that allows these humans, whether they're humans at that point or whether they become humans when these gifts are given is a kind of interesting question. That has been discussed in the literature. So I think the larger thing that I need to flesh out a little bit more is how is Socrates in this dialogue particularly playing shame again, using shame as a leverage to turn Hippocrates to think about what does it really mean to study with Protagoras and to blush when you realize that what you're saying is you want to be a sophist, right? And then, of course, the Alcibiades moment where Protagoras is, at least as reported by Socrates, again, you know, whether he felt shame or not is another whole question, but Socrates says he thinks he did. And so then the question would begin to be sort of how does the question of justice relate to shame? And is there a way in which we can think about the different dimensions of shame, namely shame as being a very off-putting and limiting and diminishing kind of characteristic versus shame as being something that can be leveraged in the name of justice or as a part of the process of transforming somebody's attention to questions of justice. And so I think the issue in that regard also might be interesting to think about the public nature of this discussion, where it's happening in the House of Callias with all of these, you know, big name people. I mean, there's a pretty significant public there. But it's, you know, it's so that's playing a role in that whole, the logic of shame and justice. So I'd be interested in hearing more about that too. But Sean, and then we'll go.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I was wondering about one description of Socrates that I've always thought has a kind of privileged status in a certain sense is Alcibiades' description in the Symposium because at the beginning of that, Alcibiades says, right, I'm not going to praise Eros, I'm going to praise Socrates, and Alcibiades says, if I say anything false, Socrates, you take it and let me know, right, and then Socrates does it. And one of the points that Alcibiades makes that has always been very striking to me is this extreme atopos character of Socrates, right? The strangeness, but literally this out-of-placeness, right? And I've always wondered about that in relation to another characteristic of Socrates, that is that he's so at home in Athens that he never leaves Athens only to become a soldier or to fight as a soldier, also in the Phaedrus when he goes outside the city walls and this. But that he's this completely immersed figure, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's totally a fixture in Athens and completely at home there, and yet he's profoundly atopos in some sense, right?
Yeah.
And so I've always wondered about that tension. I think it belongs together somehow in Socrates, that somehow Plato would want us to think, in order to be completely at home in a community, completely at home in a polis, we have to also be completely out of place at the very center of that community life. That there has to be it's not just outside the city walls that we're out of, we are out of place or something like that. So I was wondering about that in relation to your, in the site of dialogical community that you were talking about.
Yeah. Okay, let me see if I can try to respond to that sort of question of being at home and the strangeness of Socrates, the simultaneity of that. But first, I just want to comment on this question of the pregnant silence, because we heard yesterday, was it yesterday? We heard about the different silences, some that are pregnant and others that are just silent, you don't know. And I wonder if when Alcibiades in the Symposium says, okay, invite Socrates to object, and Socrates doesn't, that seems to me clearly an indication that the fact that Socrates didn't say anything there was meaningful. Whereas with the auditor not saying something in this context, I don't know. I mean, what that says about, I don't know if that is a pregnant silence or not. I'm willing to consider all possibilities there. Then the question is: is the strangeness of Socrates even as a kind of being at home or and a familiarity? So I know you've done some work on that, Sean, and I think that you're onto something really important with regard to the role that strangeness or making things strange plays in the Socratic activity of philosophy. So part of what Socrates is doing is making what we think is so familiar and understood to us strange to us. And so that's really important. I think that's an important dimension of Socrates' philosophical practice, which I'm associating very strongly with the kind of political practice. And this actually now I'm going to try and see if I can weave something that Emma was talking about this morning about oikos and metoikos into this, because maybe part of Socrates' being at home is an attunement to strangeness, an attunement to the unheimlich that offers us a picture of how to be with one another in ways that don't consider being at home about building big walls and excluding others and keeping others in and monitoring boundaries in that way, but that is more fluid, and maybe the dynamic that's at work in Socrates' relations with others and the rich variety of those relationships, the fact that he'll be different to certain people than others, depending on who they are. Really has something to teach us about how we need to be with one another politically in a way that's not hegemonic or dominational in an exclusionary in a way. Calliope, yeah. Yeah. No, and then Ryan. Go ahead. Yeah, Calliope. Sorry.
I was interested actually when I was sort of extending this question of topology. Yeah, in the Phaedrus, Phaedrus calls it the prototype. But I'm interested in this in the middle, in the middle. And if you can say a little bit, what do you mean, how exactly you mean that? I mean, I have in mind Kito's kind of ending in the Greek, saying that the Greek middle is not basically anodyne; it's always coming out of a sense of extreme polarity, and it's in a sense always kind of a dream rather than an actual place that you can get to. And so, just thinking of your example, that at the end he takes Hippocrates with him.
Yeah.
Right? But what are the stakes? I mean, yeah, he changes his schedule.
Yeah.
But in a sense, also, what are the stakes that he asks from the other person to come to that middle? Is it really a middle, or is it that someone mm-hmm. has to completely, had already changed themselves to even go to that bedroom and ask?
Right. Right. Yeah, no, I appreciate it. So the question of the middle and so a number of things I would want to draw out on that. One is, I was thinking you were going to point me to that, but I was trying, for the middle, I was pointing to that moment when Hippias says, okay, Pythagoras and Socrates, get in the middle, right here, and that is a pretty strongly agonistic situation. And Socrates is a little bit harsh there, too, because he says, well, nobody could judge us, you know, don't even deign to judge us, because you would have to be as good as us, and that's ridiculous. So we will be directly relating to one another, and you can, if you want, you know, from the, you all together could serve as judges. So there's something, so part of the reason for emphasizing that is I don't want to give this idealized picture of Socrates. I want to recognize him as sometimes getting caught up in the agonistic in ways that are destructive. I think there's some times in this particular dialogue where he doesn't treat Pythagoras really fairly. I think Pythagoras is trying to make some more subtle points than Socrates is willing to allow him to have. So I want to say that. But then I think the more interesting aspect of what you're asking is sort of what is at stake, and how could we describe the dynamics of this middle? And there I would want to hold it as dynamic and open, as dynamically open, and at least in this dialogue, the point that Socrates emphasizes is that Pythagoras and he, Socrates, have to be directly related to one another. That has to be the two of them talking, and the others will be involved in a certain kind of way. So there's a directness about it. But then what I'm really interested in is what is the unstable nature of that middle. And what are the excellences we need to cultivate in ourselves, and that Socrates himself, I think, is trying to cultivate in himself and in the people that he meets to make that middle not a contested, destructive place, but one that is actually open and at least open to new possibilities of relation that might be oriented toward the good and toward the just. And so what are the habits and excellences we need to cultivate in ourselves to inhabit that space in that way. So, but I'd like to hear more about the dynamics of that middle.
Do we have 6 minutes?
Okay. So this is Ryan, and then we'll go around this. Ryan.
Yeah. Thanks. I'd like to ask about the temporal
dimension
of your paper here, and the place of the hurrah in that. It seems like you emphasize the natural aspects of hurrah, right? Calling it sort of organic, sort of a lived life, lived natural life. But I'm also wondering, if it's something that it seems to be more attuned to the future as opposed to the past. And just what motivates me to ask this is the question of tradition that comes up immediately when the hurrah is invoked.
Right.
So when Socrates says, yeah, well, that's your opinion on Alcibiades, but if you check out Homer, he actually tells you something.
Right.
And this comes into play as well when there's a when it seems like there's a struggle for authority between sort of the ancient art of sophistry, and it turns out, well, who knew Homer was a sophist?
Right.
And other sculptors and these guys, even athletes.
Right.
And this is answered by Socrates later on, talking about how philosophy itself is an ancient art.
Yeah.
That, as we all know, comes from Sparta and Crete, so, you know, these sorts of places. So I'm just wondering, how do you, and again, I'm thinking of this in terms of Hippias' distinction between sort of Busus and Nomos that he invokes when he's trying to get them to come together in the middle. But how do you situate the hurrah in relationship to tradition?
Yeah.
Especially given the sort of, what seems to be your taking at face value, the sort of jettisoning of the poets there in that conversation as well.
Yeah. Okay. It's a good question. So, first of all, a very wise friend of mine named Ryan Drake pointed me to a couple of places in the text that, when we did our little digital dialogue together, that reinforced the idea that the hurrah in this text, and even its colloquial sense, has this natural connection to the rhythms, to the seasons, to that. So, I want to emphasize that. And as a way of maybe getting at the larger question about the tradition and the futurity of it, I think Socrates' points about the plan that he had for the day, or at least having some place to go, speaks to the fact that there is this futural dimension to the proper time. Now, with regard to the past, I also think that... I would be tempted to give a robust Greek story of Greek naturalism to this temporality, to say that, well, part of being living a life is to have had certain things handed down to one, right? And so that's where a kind of the tradition comes in to play. Now, what Socrates really means by rejecting the poets in a certain kind of way is a complicated issue, but one that would need to be answered, I think, in terms of a reading of what he's doing with Simonides and how he performs, as you yourself talk about, how he performs a reading that is, in a certain way, a violating of Simonides, perhaps, but a speaking in his own voice. He sort of performs this, what one might attempt to do. But it does open up all kinds of important questions about how we are reading these texts and what it would mean to retrieve these texts in this way, and how we are related to them, as more dialogues. Got a 2-minute warning. All right, I have time for one more question. If I have Michael, that's going to be 2 minutes right there. All right.
I'll keep it.
Okay.
Based on Anne Marie's comments, Alcibiades, the unnamed friend, recognizes Socrates is a little bit heated. That could be because he's hunting Alcibiades. We also, you pointed out the reference, would you be ashamed, blush, to consort with sophists? So I sort of have two questions very briefly that I'd like to see you try to tie together in an answer. One is, could Socrates be blushing from shame for some of the ways he treated Protagoras in the conversation that you mentioned?
Mm-hmm.
Two, your aligning of Alcibiades and Hermes, metaphorically, do you have anything similar, shamefully, some similar kinds of shame that Alcibiades will feel in the future, or people feel towards Alcibiades for cutting off the phalluses?
The lack of shame, right? So my real response to that, I don't know about Socrates' shame, although I'd like to think more about that, but it does bring me to the one point that you were making, whether Alcibiades leaves with Socrates. And I'm tempted to argue, no, he doesn't, because we know about Alcibiades, right? Because he didn't learn his lessons, which was to go back and live a good life, not try to take over all kinds of power. The politics that Socrates is teaching people about is not the politics of taking glory and authority. It's very, I think, counterposed to that sort of vision. And so Alcibiades' lack of shame might be reflected in Hippocrates' ability to feel shame and therefore to go with Socrates. So there might be the way to argue against Alcibiades going with him that way. I don't know. 1 minute. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.